The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So the variety is there as well as the variety of practice areas. And I would accredit that to, that is accredited to the fact that the federal government is an anchor point here in terms of providing legal jobs. And you have all of the federal agencies with practice areas as inclusive as international human rights, and we'll sort of talk about where international human rights might be practiced in the U.S. government, you know, political context notwithstanding, as well as the private sector industries that have blossomed around the federal government, in addition to responding to the local economic dynamics of the D.C. metropolitan area. 15 years ago, when the internet wasn't here, telecommunications law wasn't really around. It's a very different economy than you have today. And as a result, you have law firms that have come here from New York and have grown from 3, 4, 5 person offices to 30, 40, 50 person offices. So again, not only the local economics, the local demand for lawyers has grown, it's also created a growth for variety in practice areas. So that's all good news. And that doesn't even speak to the other areas that hire lawyers, such as the NGOs, the other employers, the associations. But certainly, you're going to be more concentrated, I would think, as a entry-level population on traditional career trajectories in the private sector, in the public sector, judicial clerkships. D.C. Superior Court has one of the most highest number of entry-level law clerk positions. Some states don't even have law clerks. They only have permanent law clerks. They don't have one-year judicial clerkships. So again, D.C. offers a great variety in terms of clerkships. Certainly nonprofit, WCL graduates usually twice the national average of folks that go into public interest law, close to about 8% each year. And there are lots of opportunities here in the public sector, public interest sector, NGO sectors for those kinds of practices. You want to take some stuff from there, Dan? I have other stuff to talk about, or how do you want to proceed?
Maybe we should get some ideas on what they're looking to get out of it.
Okay. Excellent. Pose the question.
Well, what are some bits of information that you all were hoping to get out of coming here today? Because we want to make sure that while we provide you with a lot of stuff that we know about, we're really addressing exactly what it is that you're coming from. So feel free to let us know right now any questions that you have, specific things that are on your mind, things that if you knew would help you better chart your career. And at the same time, you may not know what to ask, so we'll, you know, throughout the presentation, if you have questions, something jogs your mind, feel free to raise your hand. So, sure.
More like international public interest, international development. It seems like every job I ever see, none of them are entry level ever. So if you're going to try to do that, what do you do after your experience before you get in with your law degree?
It's a great question. The international, not even just public interest, but international as a whole, that's a question that a lot of law students and that's important. We'll go over that and explain.
There's a rumor going on that if you start out at a mid-sized firm or a small firm, it's harder to get into a bigger firm.
She heard the rumor, Dan.
So, transitioning from small to mid firms or the government into larger firms. Okay, good question. Is this for purposes of like fall recruiting or? Okay, so how this would be addressed on an interview or?
Right, or if you do like a send letter, or you meet with networking attorneys, how do you approach it?
Okay, so multiple practice areas?
Just I guess generally trends in practice areas, like new or growing ones, or ones that are fading or not as big anymore.
Okay, so hot and cold practice areas. Okay. A lot of you are nodding your heads, yes.
How to get into small firms.
How to get into small firms.
Well, I mean, I guess okay. It's cool there's such emphasis placed on the large firm recruitment process and not
Okay. So when you say smaller firm, do you mean 1 to 5 people or anything?
Anything less than 40.
Yeah, anything less than 40. Maybe okay. Just like the smaller firms that aren't necessarily always doing, you know, that aren't doing the big recruitment, that aren't necessarily looking to hire, you know, 100 people.
The other 98% of the law firms
exactly.
Out there. Gotcha. Okay.
I guess the potentials or prospects that have ladder from a contract position.
Okay. Okay.
Get into in-house.
Okay.
Kind of on the same line of questioning about the small firm stuff, like because they hire on an as-needed basis, it's going to be sort of like the typical job interview where they, you know, post an opening and you go interview for it. And I guess the question is, what? I know there are some, I guess, you know, magic buzzwords you can use if you're looking for, but I mean, what are the
was that for in-house or was that, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning.
For small firms. But I guess you could apply that same question to any kind of firm.
Right, okay.
What do firm hiring managers?
What are small firms looking for from a candidate?
Okay.
Lobbying firms and breaking into those and kind of what the, especially with the political climate right now, what kind of things they're looking
for. Okay. Okay.
Wait a second. What do you mean? I want
to
get straight
trends,
on that. Yeah, hiring trends.
Just the size, just on-campus recruiting. Firms are now using another method.
Okay. So alternatives to on-campus recruiting. Right. Okay.
How many hours you guys have? This is great. I mean, this is a lot of stuff and all perfectly great and relevant.
Along the in-house council, what strategy should you do for us to do 2 years of experience at the firm to get real experience that you can transition more quickly?
So when is the best time to go in-house? Okay, so the type of experience needed to go in-house and the length of time to do it quicker. Okay. These are great questions, everybody. When I was in law school, I really wouldn't have even known to ask any of these questions. So it just shows how far ahead law students are.
Yeah, but the 1800s were different times.
Listen to me talking. He's a kid compared to me.
All right, that's it. We don't care if you have other questions. That's too many.
So should we, do you think what we can do is either go through and sort of give our talk about the market, or what we can do is answer your questions, literally going through here and interweaving in specifics about the D.C. market. That would probably be the easiest thing to do.
Let's ask the crowd.
What do you guys want? Go through the questions, then explain them?
We're prepared to talk about a lot of stuff, and you obviously have a lot of stuff on your minds. So, I mean, we could give you content either way, driven by your particular questions today, or somewhat overshadowed by just a discussion of practice area by practice area. Except to say they're mutually exclusive. I think we could do a fair job integrating both.
Yeah, you're not going to miss anything if we answer your questions.
Yeah.
It's not like we're going to be leaving out stuff. We'll just...
And at the end of the day, when we address all this, we feel that we haven't covered select practice areas, we'll just jump into those. You feel like, hey, guys, you didn't touch antitrust. What's the status of the market now? We'll speak to that. Does that sound good? Great. Let's do it.
We can start off by saying at the end of this, we've got some handouts here.
Yeah.
That we will give to you, which go through, I created a chart, goes through all the different practice areas in Washington, D.C., and then the market size, whether it's a small market, a medium-sized market, or a larger market. And the size of the market, it generally determines how many positions there are. And then the next column talks about the hiring demand, whether there's a high hiring demand or a lower hiring demand. The next column talks about the pickiness, which is the emphasis on credentials. And then the last column talks, I call it the sexiness factor, which is the more the sexy, the sexier the area, the more applicants apply to certain positions. So you will see when you review this that you have the best chance of finding a position in a market that is large, where there's a high hiring demand, but it's not very picky. So this will, don't worry about jotting down everything furiously, because we will give you, you know, several page chart here that you could take with you.
And you're not getting it now, so you can't leave early, you can't just, but so that's going to really provide a lot of this data for you. And my bad, presented to the University of Michigan Law School, this was a, Dan had sent me some materials, this one was one he presented to University of Michigan, and he provided me a more recent, although not entirely different, snapshot that I will gladly post on the Document Library of eCampus Recruiter. So the fact is that Dan's been talking to other law schools about the dynamics of the DC job market, and obviously knows what he's talking about. So, but don't feel slighted that at University of Michigan, or up here at School of Law, we kick their butts.
AU's got a much better football team.
That's right. The first question that started off was international law, more particularly international development. What the heck's a career in international law? I mean, that's a whole program. We'll be doing more programs on that. But let's at least address parts of it now. Certainly WCL has one of the highest ranked national programs in international law. But what does that all mean? What does that mean? How does that translate to me in terms of my interest in international law career? Well, I slammed that tennis ball right back to you, saying, well, what the heck do you mean by your international law career? One of your colleagues articulated more precisely, well, I'm speaking international development, perhaps, in the public interest. And that's a very good focus question. I'll get to that in a moment. We'll get to that. But it deserves a broader sort of introduction in terms of how many of you here how many of you here are interested in international law? International trade law? Okay. Against which country, just a few days ago, did the EU, Canada, the United States join together in going to the WTO with problems about that country's import of auto parts?
China,
right. Good. Point being, you have to be, and good for you, you have to be, if you're interested in international trade, you have to be on top of what's going on in the marketplace. And if you want a career in international law, you have to understand, well, is it international trade specifically you're interested in? And that is the anti-dumping, countervailing duty dynamics of what's going on, as that's practiced in the ITA, the ITC, the World Trade Organization, and trade groups here in town. And or are you interested in the harmonized tariff system? Are you interested in customs law and the classification of these things being ink delivery devices, dutiable at 1.8%, or bold color dry erase, dutiable at 19.7%. Your client's going to pay you a lot of money who's manufacturing these in Germany or Taiwan to import them under the lower duties. Do you understand those dynamics? And or are you talking about, no, well, I was thinking more about, I don't know, that international transactional stuff, you know, when I fly on the jets and write contracts from Paris to New York every other week, and we put that out there as a naive understanding of how someone launches their international law career, except I was talking to an alumna a few years ago who actually ended up with that job. I mean, you talk about it, but there she was, and she said she had to take one more flight to Paris and leave her apartment in New York. She was going to slit her wrists. Get me the hell out of this job. Be careful of what you wish for. It's nothing like what she thought it would be. It's basically like practicing law in New York, except you're not in Manhattan. You're sitting on a bloody plane and going back and forth. And or are you talking about working with the Gates Foundation on HIV prevention mechanics in Africa and working on international development issues with microloans and AID contractors like Chemonix and the like. So the point is, you have to be a much more sophisticated career job searcher out there when it comes to international law and all of your other practices. You know, we're not going to go through that analysis on all of them, but that's just to give you a for example with the big ticket item up there. And to answer your colleague's question, of course, it can't just be answered in a moment or two. I happen to actually pull out of a resource that we have in career services on international development work with the U.S. federal government. So which agency has an international development practice? USAID, go, right? State Department. Library of Congress, huh? What are you talking about? Library of Congress, Congressional Research Service, Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade Division, Resources, Science, and Industry Division. How about the Millennium Challenge Corporation, also tied to USAID? How about the EPA, or the African Development Foundation, or the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, Office of International Affairs, very much goes into markets, tries to develop new securities markets. Trade and Development Agencies, USAID, OPIC, there are, and others, Department of Agriculture, I mean, you know, those modified, genetically modified grains and rices that are banned from a lot of countries, but also help produce more in, you know, in Africa and other regions where it's a harder growing climate. Point being, again, don't look just to the no-brainers where everyone else is running. You know, I want to do international development work, go to AID and some of these other places, but there are resources, talk to the counselors, there are resources to point you to many other federal agencies. Does it exist on the private side? Do you see it existing anywhere on the private side, Dan?
The biggest mistake that law students make when they're interviewing, whether it's for small, medium, or large firm, is coming in and saying they want to do international. That I get that comment all the time from experienced attorneys saying, if you're speaking to law students, tell them not to walk in and say, I want to do international law. Because there's no such a thing as international law in private practice. Yes?
Touching on that, I only ask, what you're saying, what if you talk about how you want to work in a specific field of law? Like,
right.
For instance, tariff negotiation,
sure.
Interpretation, but you go into your firm and you say, I want to work on an international scale. This is the type of subject area I want to be in, and as this firm grows and our clients grow globally, I want to be somebody at this firm who helps take this subject matter on an international level.
What I would do, that's a very good question, and what I would, sort of the second part of my answer here is that there are a lot of issues that involve, or a lot of subject matters that involve cross-border issues, some international related issues, you know, tariffs, some international trade, project finance, that are on an international scale, but you need to first find the area of law and the specific practice, which is what you're interested in doing. And the fact that it may be international or have cross-border issues, such as mergers and acquisitions that involve international cross-border matters, or, you know, project finance with Latin American companies, or international trade that's dealing with import and export, or immigration, or something like that, those are all secondary, ancillary issues to the area of law that you're interested in. So the mistake is not that you want to deal with international related issues, but coming in and saying, I want international law. Because law schools sort of focus on international law. You have a course called international law. And a lot of people fall into the trap of thinking that there's such a practice area called international law once you get out there. There's really not. It's the other types of practice areas that have international clients or international related issues. So I think that the smartest thing you can do is to focus on the practice area first, and then to the extent there may be international related issues, add that as something that you're also interested in working on. But don't go in focusing on just international. Now, this is limited primarily to the private sector, law firms primarily, you know, mid or smaller, larger law firms. Now, if there's a firm that specializes, a very rare firm that specializes in international issues, then that's an exception. But this is something that applies to, I'd say, 98% of the law firms out there.
Let's get right to also to the heart of that second question, and we have a lot of others to go through. Now, how do you get into things like international development, which they don't hire out of law school, folks? That's the short answer to it. Very, you know, I would love for any of you here to be the exception, and one of you may, but generally speaking, it just happened that way. So it's understanding your preferred career and reverse engineering what it's going to take to get there. Okay, I actually want to end up with that AIB job doing this kind of work. Who do they hire? How do I get there? I'll tell you what I've seen them hire. I've seen them hire crackerjack securities lawyers off of Wall Street firms. I've seen them hire folks from Office of International Affairs, from the SEC. I see them hire, you know, real pedigree lawyers. They want crackerjack lawyers. Whether or not you have a, they'll hire a master in public health, thank you very much, over a lawyer any day to service the World POP and global health units. So it's understanding how you want to do this kind of work, in what context, and then reverse engineering how to get there. Talking to people at AID, lawyers at AID, talking to us, talking to Dan, talking to other people in the know about eventually if I want to be here, what do I need to do in law school to make myself an interesting candidate to the first career post-law school, which will get me to the second career, which will get me to AID, or the first career to AID. So it's reverse engineering this, understanding the realities. What can I be doing my second year and third year in law school? What classes can I be taking? What externships or internships for no money can I be doing to make my resume that much more powerful and obviously dedicated to the cause? And what skill sets can I be getting vis-a-vis litigation, transactional, et cetera, that are going to make myself very interesting to those practice groups?
Right.
So you might find yourself doing representing local, an immigrant population in the field of domestic violence, using your Spanish skills for a year and a half to make yourself an interesting candidate for a human rights kind of position. Very germane, very transferable kinds of issues. Let's move on.
All right, hard to go from small to large firm. Generally, that is the rumor, and I think there is some truth to that, but it all depends on the particular practice area. The reason why it's harder to go from a smaller firm to a larger firm is large firms have the mentality that at smaller firms, you get better frontline experience, you're thrown into the fray quicker, you've got much more client contact, but the training that you've received may not be to their standards. So I think it is generally, I mean, I've seen a lot of people go from small firms to large firms. It depends on the practice area. For example, patent law, which is very marketable, corporate, which is very marketable, and sort of specialty areas that there's that they're in a small area, but where there's a high hiring demand, if you have experience in that area, it's much easier to go. However, generally, it's easier to go from a larger firm to a smaller firm because just the training that you've received at the larger firm is very attractive to smaller firms. But it certainly can happen, and it does happen, but it depends what type of practice specifically. Government, it depends on the area. If it's something like the SEC or the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, or the Food and Drug Administration, or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, these are all things that it's attractive to law firms. So what you need to do, it's not just the government into private practice. You need to look at the law firm practice areas, which practice areas focus on government entities and have clients that are dealing with regulatory issues in the big money-making areas. And if you can go to those government agencies, you will be much more in demand from a law firm because you'll be bringing your expertise into a law firm. So I get a lot of calls from people saying, you know, we'd like people from the Department of Justice that have experience doing securities or white-collar fraud litigation, or Federal Trade Commission, the SEC, the FDA, FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. These are just some of the big agencies that are helpful to transition to private practice. So it all depends on the practice.
So yeah, what Dan's saying is really you got to follow the money. I mean, law firms are there to service money clients. Large law firms are large corporate clients, which federal agencies regulate the activities of those corporate clients.
That's going to be a direct connection,
right.
Number one. Number two, to the extent that you're 2 or 3 years out of law school in a smaller firm practice, they're still going to be looking, and Dan can speak much more knowledgeably than I, about your performance in law school. They still want to know, what was your GPA? It's not like you could say, well, I had a 3.15 GPA, and I had a B in securities practice, and I went to a small law firm and did some securities law, some civil litigation, and then you're going to be interesting to a large law firm 2 or 3 years later. I mean, some of the entrance analysis is the same. How well did you do in law school? We're still looking at that stuff. So you have to recognize those dynamics as well. P.S., why do you want to go to a law firm? And you have to sort of explore those dynamics. Is it just because you think that's success, that's the money, that's where you want to be? It very well might be all three. You might be very happy there. But recognize that there are a lot of satisfying careers and very lucrative careers. I worked for a very boutique firm in New York doing international trade law where the partners there were making much more money than the senior partners at Skadden. So look beyond just the initial.
Yeah, I completely second that. It's not large law firm or nothing. There are plenty of people that take interesting circuitous routes and end up at the same places, much more marketable, promoted much quicker than people that started off since their first year. So keep that in mind.
I guess narrowing down the question more to the area of wealth management or trust and estate, how does your answer change if you're going from a small firm to a large firm?
Very difficult. Coming from a small boutique firm that does trust and estates and wealth management, there are several...
And they want to go into that same
area.
Area.
Like, I mean, a couple firms have, strong wealth management practices. But again, it's the odd. There are a few firms with a few partners that do this type of work. So the number of positions is pretty limited. That being said, there are not that many people that are really doing that type of work right outside of law school, so the market is also small. If you have a tax background, that can make you even more marketable. But again, it's not one of the typical practices of a large firm because most people are more comfortable going to a smaller 2 to 4 person firm in Bethesda or Maryland because the rates are much cheaper because they're individual clients as opposed to corporate clients.
And I would add some things to that. Credentials, as Dan said. Are you coming with an LLM in tax from NYU, Florida, or Georgetown? You're a different candidate from that 3-person boutique firm. When you were doing wealth management in Bethesda, were these $3 to $5 million net worth individuals, sophisticated drafting Q-tip trusts, et cetera? Or are you just doing, $500,000 estates, $200,000 to $300,000 estates, everyday wills and things like that. What's the level of sophistication? Are you bringing any of these clients with you, bringing this money with you? I worked a little bit on the Warhol estate and some of the Bush estate up in the New York firm that had a tremendous trust in estates practice. There were a few folks that made it there because they brought with them a book of business. So there are lots of different rationales that large firms will absorb you or not, and lots of things you can do proactively to make yourself more happier. And lots of folks leave large law firms saying, the hell with this, why am I giving my piece of the pie to this corporate group that's not making money? I'm going on my own. I'll hang my own shingle. My clients will come with me. I'm the same brain. And then ancillary. Why don't you think about working for Morgan Stanley, Fidelity, personal wealth management. Requires lawyers there as well as investment advisors. Are you a hybrid? You take a Series 6, Series 7. You can sell little securities on the side. You could be very much more wealthy than the slog at mega firm drafting another Q-tip trust.
Right. Exactly. That's one of the areas where you can really be an entrepreneur. Next question, public to private and vice versa?
Sort of address it a little bit.
Yeah, for me it's the same type of answer with the government to a law firm. It all depends on the area. Usually public interest positions where you're doing something good for the society that's not focused on the big money-making clients, it's harder to sell yourself going into a law firm because people in the law firm will be thinking, why didn't you go from a law firm to the beginning? Is your heart really in public interest? And if it is, that's fantastic, but you may not like working for the man, so to speak.
And nowhere more than D.C. do you have an acceptance between this revolving door, private-public, public-private. People do it here more than anywhere else for obvious reasons, because You know, there's many federal opportunities here, and there's a tremendous administrative regulatory practice in D.C. law firms, which draw on the expertise from senior folks at FERC, at EPA, at DOJ, et cetera. So it's a very real dynamic here. It happens very well. I was just speaking with an alumna who left an ERISA practice, Employee Retirement Incentive Savings Act, I said that right, at the Department of Labor, doing very well, and she's moved out to Iowa. I spoke with her yesterday, and there are very few but some select in-house positions with insurance companies and private practices that she's going to be very interesting to. But beyond that, nothing. There's no ERISA practice in the large firms out there. There's two or three people that do it. So your jurisdiction, where you're going, we'll have a lot to say about that, too, in terms of the demand for your expertise in the private.
It's usually easier to go if you have a foundation in private practice and then you want to go into public interest for a couple of years and then you want to go back to a law firm. It's easier to go if you have the base in a law firm. It's easier to go into public and then back into private rather than going straight from public.
How does the transition work if you were to have a clerkship with a judge and then want to go into private? I mean, coming out of a clerkship where you don't necessarily have an area of specialties, how do you make yourself marketable at that point?
What kind of clerkship do you have in mind?
Well, that's kind of my follow-up question. I mean, what is the impact if you were a D.C. Superior Court versus something on the appellate level or something like that? How that affects
What I've found for clerkships are really good primarily for litigation positions because that's the skill that you're observing and learning is litigation. Depending on the court that you're at, if it's a federal court, you're much more marketable wherever you want to go. For the appellate positions, I'll just mention this right now because you mentioned appellate. Do not try to get a position as an appellate clerk, a federal appellate court clerk, unlike now any of the circuits, unless you're really absolutely top of your class. It's really, I don't want to say don't try because anything's possible, but those are very, very competitive positions. And the appellate practices in D.C. in private practice at all the firms, if you look at the pedigree of the attorneys, they either clerk for the Supreme Court, clerk for an appellate court, Harvard, cum laude, you know, really, really, really highly credentialed. So appellate practice is another mistake that a lot of law students make is they start talking about appellate work when they don't necessarily have the background or the pedigree to do that. And all it does is it hurts your chances because it shows that to the firm that you haven't really studied what's required to get into that field. So be careful if you're going to focus on appellate or if you're going to mention that in an interview. Really think twice and make sure that you've got that it's not really a ridiculous long shot because so many people want to go into appellate because it's kind of a sexy brief writing area, but it's extremely competitive. Now, for your question about clerking, I think if you don't have a what you can do is contact firms with litigation practices. There'll be a lot of firms that are interested in speaking to clerks, especially firms that litigate in the court at which you clerked. That is, if you're in another city, if you're clerking in a particular court, you'll have the best chance if you can get a position in a firm that litigates frequently in that particular jurisdiction or court because they want you for your expertise and inside knowledge of the judge's personality and how plaintiffs, defendants can do things better. So that's my advice on how to really use the clerkship to your best advantage. The people, the attorneys that are representing the client in your court, those are the people that the firms or practices you want to go to.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So you come from the Supreme Court, God bless you, you're going anywhere. You come from an appellate court, federal circuit, you got a ticket to ride to. These are very prestigious positions that you should apply for if you want to apply for them. Speak with Shelley Rudge, our judicial clerkship coordinator. She's top-notch. We had 16% of WCL alumni went into clerkships from the class of 2005. That's up from, I think, 11% from the previous years. I mean, you guys are really going into clerkships out there, and they are highly transferable and fungible kinds of practice areas. Now, to the extent that you're in a court of original jurisdiction, to the extent that you're in a court that's a criminal docket, et cetera, that can sort of lock you more into that kind of career trajectory, versus a more multifaceted docket of general civil litigation, et cetera. At the local level, you're going to make those great contacts. You're going to see Joe Blow from Joe Blow and Joe Blow Associates, and he's going to see you, and you're going to make those kinds of connections. You're going to have that kind of ability. It's a very, it's if you're not sure what the next step is going to be, it's probably your safest career step in terms of being most transferable out there. And there's no doubt the higher the pedigree, the more leverage it has. And as Dan said, certainly the higher the pedigree, the more competitive it is. But sit down, let's see what your background's like, what your application is like, and let's talk about what the realities are, you know, with this statistics, et cetera. You know, you have a shot at the federal clerkships, or possibly not. If you want to try it, go for it. And you might want to also try these clerkships, et cetera. So,
and even aside from marketability, it's just a really good skill. I know we're talking about markets and, you know, how to best position yourself, but if you're interested in litigation or dealing with courts in any capacity, it's a fantastic way to really understand how things actually get done. And that's something that will take you years and years to figure out, and you'll have a leg up over the competition. Even if you see partners at firms that are senior partners, you know, 30, 40 years out in practice, their bio starts off with their schools and then says they clerk for so-and-so judge upon graduation from law school. So it's something that you'll carry with you for years and years. So it's something that you should really seriously think about if you are interested in litigation.
You want to do wealth management? Go work in the Gould Court down in Manhattan. You work in the probate court down there. You're going to be a pretty interesting candidate.
Actually, I was just curious, going back to the public-private transition, another rumor circulates.
Okay.
The rumor that in D.C., public interest is so competitive that if you worked at a firm, you're like blacklisted because you didn't always do public interest.
Like most rumors, that one is somewhat asinine. But and I'm not attributing it to you at all. I'm just because you were brave enough to articulate it. And like everything else, there's an angle of truth to it, and there's a whole lot of BS to it. So if you went to public interest, what's your background before going to the firm? Then you went to mega firm for 2 years to make the money, pay off your loans, etc. Public interest organizations most are going to just welcome you back in with open arms. Don't think you're going to go working for D.C. Legal Aid if you work at the Attorney General's office. Certainly there are things you can do to torpedo your credentials in terms of the next step public interest-wise. But public interest is sophisticated. It's very competitive here in D.C. People in the top 5% of the class with $100,000 worth of debt are dying to give it away for $35,000 a year. I mean, it is very competitive here. That doesn't mean there aren't opportunities, but it's competitive. But in terms of hiring laterally later on, they're not expecting lockstep, oh, well, you gave up the cause. Again, there's some exceptions. And if you have a particular interest, a particular targeted employer, one or two or three, ask them, you know what, I really want to end up here. It looks like I'm not going to get there now. I'm considering, as an interim step, working, get the best darn legal skills possible. Because what do? You litigate human rights issues. I want to be a damn good commercial litigator in this firm. Does that work for you? We'd love to see you in 3 years. Or don't you dare show up in 3 years. Ask them. I dare say 9 times out of 10, the answer is going to be go for it, become the best damn lawyer you can be, and come back to what you want to do.
I think I agree with everything Matthew said. And the concern, the reason why you're, quote, blacklisted is I think a lot of times public interest organizations are concerned that the only reason that you're looking to go is because you want a better lifestyle. So it's important to show that it's not, I went to the law firm and I'm tired of working hard, so I want to sort of take a vacation. So that is what the concern is. So to the extent you can highlight in your resume any previous public interest work, or if you do pro bono on the side or volunteer, and show that you've got that type of that type of personality, it will help buffer any presumptions. How to
approach a firm with multiple practice areas and your multiple interests? That is, how not to box yourself in if you're not. How do you pitch yourself to a firm that has 5 to 10 practice areas and you think you're interested in at least 2 or 3 of them?
The it's perfectly fine to be interested in several areas because it's actually, generally speaking, firms don't want someone that is gung-ho, only interested in one practice area because let's say they lose a big client or let's say the economy changes. They want someone that's going to be flexible. So it's okay to say I'm interested in, you know, a couple of practice areas, but what you want to do is be able to articulate why you're interested in the areas. Not just I'm interested in corporate and litigation. Why? Because they both seem interesting. I'm interested in litigation because I love writing. I love advocacy. I was very involved in moot court and journal. I love briefing, researching. It's part of my personality. However, corporate, I also like finances and running deals, and the idea of working on, you know, reviewing these types of documents is something that appeals to me based on this coursework. I'm not quite sure. I'm open to practicing in either area or wherever you have the most work or the highest need, that's where I'd be willing to go. So I think if you keep it focused on what you're willing to do and what you're open to doing, that is going to make you pretty marketable. Now, if you're interviewing at a firm where they've got, a lot of firms have a lot of practice areas, but in reality, there's one or two bread and butter practices. If you go on a website and you see law firm websites, this is just a little bit of insider information here, not really insider, but law firms want you to think that they do everything. They will have a whole page on their website about their e-commerce practice when they only have one partner that does that 20% of their time because they want to attract clients. So from your point of view as a student, you want to make sure that when you're researching a law firm's practice area, you are understanding how many people really do that full time. Now, if there are 8 partners that work in 7 different practice areas, odds are this is a firm that a lot of people do a lot of different things. So it's more acceptable for you to hedge your bets by being broader. But if you're interviewing at a firm where 8 of the partners on their bio, on their website, is just one particular practice area, although the firm's website says that they do everything, you want to really focus on the bread and butter money-making areas. So a couple ways to do that, using the website to really focus on the number of partners that have one practice area under their bio. The NALP form is another way to do that. There's a website called nalpdirectory.org or .com,
actually.
Okay, and they've gotten the Career Services Office. Chambers and Partners is a great website to find out which firms have the strongest practice areas. And if you focus on the bread and butter practices of the firm, I think you'll be better off. But also, you want to make sure that you're not talking about having interest in areas that are completely unrelated. You don't want to come in saying, I'm interested in doing criminal defense at the same time, international trade, or something that's completely unrelated, because then it will make you look like you're not really focused. So the important thing is to have evidence of why you're interested in certain practice areas. And it's okay if it's 2 practice areas, or even maybe 3. Show that you've thought it out, and you've got good evidence for being interested, but you're open to a number of them.
Now, I just want to interject. I'm not sure if you have the room until 1 or 1:30.
1:30,
yeah, okay. You sure?
Yeah.
Great. Good.
Would it look unprofessional if I got a piece of pizza?
Yeah, very.
Okay.
Go for it. and I'll just sort of second that. Now, I've had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with...
You ate it all.
It's all gone?
You ate it all.
That was unprofessional. And I asked that question of well over 100 hiring partners from mega firm to smaller firm, and the answer just depends on, I've heard plenty of partners say, I don't care, you know, what do I know my second, third year if you know what you want to do? If you have a general interest in this, sure, articulate, et cetera. We just want smart, motivated people who are flexible, et cetera. And others that say, well, if you do have an interest, articulate it. But be careful about putting yourself in a pigeonhole, because if you're just saying, I want to do energy, I want to do energy, I want to do energy, and they sort of like your whole candidacy, yes, they like the fact that you have energy, FERC experience, but there might also be a need in litigation. I'm sensing less flexibility there, and then you might sort of talk yourself out of a job. if you're talking to a boutique or smaller firm that has more select, secluded interests, then you do want to speak to that.
Right. If it's exactly, if it's a boutique that focuses on one area, you've got to be focused.
We'll come back to the, obviously we're here for the trends, right? And there's a lot of it sort of synopsis here. But let's get to these others and roll back to the trends.
We'll take some time at the end to go through this.
Yeah. Small firm penetration, less than 40. What kind of skill sets? We'll be doing, contrary to some earlier stated comments, and it's in here in every other law school in America, the Career Service Professional Development Office only cares about the top 10%. They only do programs for fall recruitment, et cetera. If you looked at the 60 programs we did last year, 50 of them had everything to do with everything but the large firm program. What you see is a front-loaded fall recruitment process in every law school in America, because this is when the recruiting happens, and this is where you get a lot of attention in these first few months of school. And as the alumni career counselor, I can tell you that I work with everyone, as we all do. So it's nonsense. In terms of what you see, what the visibility might be, and what you choose to see, you might see a lot of stuff going on in the fall recruitment aspect. But we're here to work with 100% of the students, okay? And I said that, I lost my train of thought, as an introduction to, the small firm process. We will probably have Donna Gerson, who wrote the book on job strategies, working small, working smart. She's coming up with a new one. I'm very friendly with Donna. She and I, she's quoted me in her new book, et cetera. I do programs on small, mid-sized firms. There are some certain skill sets. There are resources for it. Suffice it to say, the dynamics are different, small firms versus large firms. A, in terms of how they recruit. They don't have clients and an income flow that allows them to project 1 year in advance what their hiring needs are going to be, so they don't do a fall recruitment process. We don't know what our summer needs are going to be. We don't need, that's not our business model. So they recruit, thank you very much, when the demand is there. And that usually means closer to the spring, and they recognize some students will be graduating, so they tend to pick up. But then again, they'll recruit on December 25th. They don't care. A new client just came in. They need a new lawyer that day. So the small firm market, you have to be much more mindful of monitoring the 365-day business cycle that they live. They're not living to your hiring needs. They're living towards what their business model is. And you have to understand that. You have to also understand that small firms, they have a very real need for the reaction. The interactive level is much closer. The degrees of separation between you and mega partner are much fewer. Therefore, the fit issue is very important. Am I going to get along with you? Of course, the midnight pizza test and the large firm on-campus interviewing is important, too. That is, if we're in a deal together and we order pizza at midnight, am I going to want to talk sports or fashion, whatever it might be, across the table from you? That's very important, the fit factor. Are you a kind of person that's going to work well with our dynamics here in this firm, because it's like a small social setting? Your skill set. We need someone here, unlike mega firm, that can afford a large learning curve. Don't worry that you don't know how to draft a motion to dismiss. You know, we'll get you there in a year, and we'll bill the client hundreds of thousands of dollars to teach you that and how to write it perfectly. Small firm says, hey, we got to do it now, tomorrow, quickly, and everything in between. So like, okay, the day after tomorrow, and there's some learning in there too. So what's your style? What are you presenting to them? Are you presenting a student that's prepared for practice, that can roll up their sleeves and get on in there? So that's going to be important. Your motivation for working with a small firm. You'd be surprised. I do mock interviews all the time where I see nothing but chips on people's shoulder. Like, basically, I'm interviewing with this firm because I didn't get my job at big firm. And you kidding? Big firm, a small firm hears that real loud and clear. Thank you very much. So what's your motivation for doing this? Are you truly committed to working with us? Why? Et cetera. In terms of the subject matter, again, can you align yourself with the fewer areas of practice that we have here? Sort of covered some broad subjects. Any of those you want to sort of pick up on? Or
The primary thing that I've had in my experience is that smaller firms want to know that people are self-starters, get up and go, and aren't prima donnas when it comes to getting their hands dirty and just jumping in and not, you know, learn by doing is the best way. So to the extent you're interviewing with these smaller firms, talk about situations where you've learned, picked up things without much guidance, where you've been able to not have a secretary or something needs to get done, taking the initiative to make it happen rather than waiting for somebody else to do it. Because at smaller firms, a lot of it's just self-initiated. it's self-initiated motivation. And to the extent you can focus on that, I think that's always appreciated and welcomed more at smaller firms in this area.
And also another thing, geographic, it goes to the fit, but you know, small firms can be much more sensitive to the fact that, well, why are you interested in working specifically in Bethesda? Mega firm doesn't really care. Of course you want to work in our New York office. Who doesn't want to work in, you know, Planet New York? So it's less of a convincing thing than you do if the smaller firm, like, hey, I really want to be here in this part of town, and I do have ties here, and I want to become involved in the community. By the way, they're probably getting some of their business from the community, so they want to see that propensity and affinity for that kind of dynamic. So these small non-legal things are going to speak very strongly to your candidacy and how successful you're going to be in this firm, and therefore their potential to extend.
And for smaller firms, a mistake that a lot of people make is they limit themselves geographically to Washington, D.C. Don't forget about Maryland, Bethesda, Rockville, Baltimore, Columbia, Maryland. I mean, there are so many firms all around out the D.C. suburbs, Northern Virginia, Roanoke, Norfolk, Richmond.
I'm going to stick Philadelphia and Delaware in there, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. Philadelphia, Delaware, a lot of very good firms, Wilmington, Delaware, where if you can show an interest or some sort of connection, you will have a very good chance of getting a foot in the door because AU is a very good law school and well-regarded, and these firms aren't used to getting a lot of candidates from schools like this, so you will be able to leverage yourself much better if you're looking for a smaller firm at one of these types of places. So don't make the mistake of limiting yourself just to Washington, D.C., and go broad. And should we talk about maybe some job search tools that people can use to find out about these different opportunities?
Sure. Why don't you start us?
Obviously, the first place I would go was to the Career Services office to talk to Matthew or another career counselor about research. There are a lot of databases. I think you guys have subscriptions to some of them that are complimentary for students.
Right.
Really, and contacting alumni is a great. So I would start with the job website, contacting alumni, and the best way to start and do all this really is to go to Career Services because they have it all nicely laid out and packaged for you so that you don't have to recreate the wheel and you'll save a lot of time. I still call the Career Services office when I have a question about researching something on my job because I know how much valuable
insight
they have.
Yeah.
I call Matt, yeah.
Big picture here, folks, because we can talk about so many different subject areas, but eCampus Recruiter, that's where our job postings. As well as other services such as attorneyjobs.com, which you can access through lawschool.westlaw.com, and under the attorney jobs is also a law student jobs. Actually, I just printed out before we came here, what did I do? Private sector and federal government jobs. Let's see, I thought I printed out one for the law students. Actually, I may have not. This is from attorneyjobs.com. Sorry. I didn't put that down for law students, but so you have job posting services. eCampus Recruiter, we have our jobs posted. The lawschool.westlaw.com has a hyperlink to attorneyjobs.com. If you go to attorneyjobs.com, you have to pay $20 a month. You get it for free through your lawschool.westlaw.com account. Within that, you have these subcategories, law school positions and lateral positions, as well as other research publications as the Federal Careers for Attorneys, which is what I was reading to you earlier about those international development and finance kinds of positions. By subject matter, they will reverse engineer the relevant federal agency that has discrete practices in antitrust, environmental law, copyright, etc. Okay. Other job posting services, Law Crossing, again, free subscription by virtue of being a WCL student. You know, it's a commercial posting on there. There's some crap on there and good stuff on there as well. It's a little bit of a sloppier, I would say, service in terms of how they vet their posting. You might find things that are dated on there. And a number of others. But that sort of begs the issue that if you're just looking for jobs on posting services, you're really doing yourself a disservice. You're not looking at what you need to be doing, the networking component. And the resources we have for networking, including the mentor database, including a Martindale search, including all the other programs that we have here.
ways to really develop your network. About 30% of law school graduates get their job ultimately from a career services-based networking approach. So between 25 and 30%. And about 25% more students get their jobs that way than through that on-campus interview process that we spend so much time with. So we really do spend much more of our time on these factors.
And if I could say one quick thing about networking, the reason it's important is from a law firm standpoint, let's say this is the time when they decide to hire an opening or post a position. What happens is, 3 months beforehand, they're getting a lot of work. Things are getting really stressful. They're not sure if they should hire somebody. And then, someone screws something up on a case because they don't have enough people. And then they start fighting about, we don't have enough support. And so then they consider it, see if they have the budget for it. And then finally, at that point, they make a decision a couple months later, or weeks later, that, all right, let's post the position. However, during this point, if you contact them with a resume right after someone screwed up a case because they didn't have enough support, they may be much more likely to say, this resume came across my desk, we should really talk to this person, and it will avoid us having to go through and post an advertisement, and it may be much easier and cheaper. So the thing is, if you're just responding to this point, odds are there are so many other people that have been contacting the firm at the same time to try to get a position, and you can preempt it and get in under the radar if you are constantly networking, contacting people, and planting seeds. So if something does come up, you could be hitting them at the right spot. So that's why sort of the whole methodology behind networking is to get something before it's advertised.
Making your own luck, putting yourself at the right place at the right time. Talked about the 365-day hiring cycle and business dynamics of a small firm. You want to read up and see and chart trends, et cetera, and see where there might be potential based on a new case was just filed against China and who's representing the Chinese clients, et cetera. You definitely want to target those folks. But just in terms of the general practices out there, you just want to be dropping lines to people and building this network. Not when you're starving looking for food here the day after graduation, I need a job, but when you're a 2L, 1L, 2L, 3L, all the way up to that point, okay? So you've been planting those seeds so that you have a bit of a garden to choose from here as opposed to being hungry and then starting to plant the seed more.
I was always impressed when I was practicing that certain law students would just email me and say, I wanted to let you know what I'm doing, I'm interested in this, if there's a need. I would always, even if there wasn't a need, I was always much more impressed that they demonstrated the type of characteristics of successful business people, because networking, going out, seizing opportunities, these are the types of people that would contact clients and be more likely to bring in business. So I think those are, it's much more than just seeing if you can get a job, but showing them that you have the important characteristics of being not only a good lawyer, but a good business person.
Good. Excellent. Okay.
Contract lawyering?
Yeah, contract lawyering and advancement therein.
There are two types of, there are probably a lot more in terms of different types of contract lawyering, but generally they're contract lawyers that are working on big document reviews, which are oftentimes in the basement of a large firm in a big conference room, or even off-site. You could be working for a large D.C. firm, but not even in the firm, but at a warehouse in Bethesda or Chevy Chase or Rockville. Those types of positions, it's not easy to get into at least a larger law firm from those. I don't know. It's also probably challenging for mid-sized firms as well, because you've really only specialized in one particular skill, which is reviewing documents for privilege. However, there's another type of contract position, which is called staff attorney, which is more like an associate, but with a different title, and they're maybe not sure if you have the credentials to justify hiring you as an associate right out of law school, or they may just need one or two people on a six-month project. Those types of positions where you're actually doing much more substantive work are obviously much more marketable because you're getting the skills that are much more transferable into the main practice areas. So those increase your chances. Now, one thing to realize if you're looking for contractor, staff attorney type of positions, you want to find out, if possible, if this is a type of position that can lead you into a permanent position, because there are a number of firms that will have staff attorneys that will be working right alongside of the associates and actually doing more than the associates, but they have no chance of advancing to an associate position because the firm has developed a policy that says we will not promote any staff attorneys. It's called temp to perm. We will not promote them because we don't want to deal with people constantly lobbying us and coming in and sliding resumes to us while we're eating lunch and that sort of thing. So I think those are the two distinctions between those types of positions, and the staff positions are much more marketable, obviously, to another type of practice.
I would just add a few more things to that. The timing, that is to say, if I go into a temporary position post-graduation, am I dead in the water? Am I not going to be marketable to other employers after that? And the answer is no. The legal industry is perfectly sensitive to the dynamics of hiring cycles and the fact that at graduation, nationally speaking, at least 30% of folks don't have their jobs in hand, and temporary assignments are a perfectly fine way to sort of generate some income, get some legal experience going during this interim process. And so, you know, if you're doing it for several months, for a few months, that could be fine. If you're doing it for a year plus, then, you know, then you're going to have some explaining to do. And then when I say you have some explaining to do, you have to also look at to whom. Are you looking at the mega firm that you're looking to transfer into that has going to have more of a snob appeal, sort of poo-poo look towards that kind of work? Or a smaller mid-sized firm or a federal agency that, hey, you know, if you've been doing work that's somewhat germane, that's subject matter driven, that could be transferable and just fine, thank you very much. And as Dan said, the difference also being between a contract position versus a staff attorney position. Staff attorney positions are, you are employees of that law firm as opposed to employees of the temporary agency. And as an employee of the law firm, you're making more money, but you're typically on, as Dan said, a different track than an associate or a partnership track. But there are very real exceptions here in town and elsewhere where there are firms that will absolutely entertain the transition from a staff attorney to a full-time associate. Just spoke with one less than a month ago in a very big firm, national, internationally. And other firms that, as a matter of fact, will not, thank you very much, as a matter of policy. So, you know, a lot of variations to it, a lot of flexibility with it, and again, if you need flexibility, it can fit that mold too.
In my experience, the people that I've seen go from these document production positions into associate positions are people that either have connections, have been out there networking with people, have written articles in their free time, have taken pro bono cases to get some other types of experience, and have been proactive about trying to bridge that. Also, on your resume, a lot of people really sell themselves short. You can either say, handle document review for big cases, or you could say, reviewed evidence for issues of a work product privilege in, you know, antitrust cases. And you can provide more context in terms of the types of field that you were working on, what you did, what you managed, how many documents there were, whether you're comfortable handling the different types of software programs that deal with document production. So by doing that, you're increasing your chances of somebody saying, huh, well, we're dealing with a big case that's got tremendous discovery. Maybe this person would be good for running discovery for this case. So don't sell yourself short on your resume if you're going to take one of these contract positions, because you can really, you know, play it up.
In-house, how to become an effective candidate. Point being that it's maybe about 1% of our graduates, of law school graduates, walk into an in-house position. Reason being that the demand, when you work in-house, you are a real cost item to that corporation. You're a line item. You're a liability. You're not an asset, necessarily, in a business context, as opposed to in a law firm. You're there generating the billable hours, which bring income into the firm. So just, they look at you differently, and therefore, as an asset, they need the most effective widget possible to fill that gap. A neophyte lawyer, a recent graduate with no work experience under his or her belt, in the practice that we're in, that is manufacturing widgets, is going to be of nominal assistance to us and having a very expensive, long learning curve for us to absorb. We would rather, thank you very much, purchase the perfect widget from as a third or fourth or fifth year lateral associate cherry-picked from the law firm that we're paying lots of dollars to come in and fill that mold. That's the sort of the in-house typical model and the rationale why you won't get a lot of entry-level in-house positions. Having said that, every year we do have WSO alumni walk right into it, and the ones that I am familiar with, four or five that I can think of off the top of my head, all work there during law school as a legal intern or something like that, and that position morphed into a full-time legal assistant position. Again, going back to the importance of building your career from day one through internships, externships, paid positions in firms, and recognizing the value of producing this experience now, whether or not there's a monetary one at present, and how that can impact your at graduation or beyond career prospects. What else would you like to add to the in-house?
Usually the advice I give people, and I hear a lot of corporate clients saying, is that they like people that have at least 5 or 6 years of experience before they go in-house, but it all depends. Generally, I think in-house positions are clients want attorneys that have substantial law firm experience because they're paying you to oftentimes manage the outside lawyers to make sure on a big litigation that they're not overcharging or that they're not getting carried away. So a lot of what you're doing is really cutting costs for the client. So oftentimes you need to have a lot of experience to be able to see things. That's just one thing that I've noticed. But it's better to wait, generally speaking, until you have some good experience before trying to go in-house, because you can really approach it too prematurely and there's just not enough value. And like, I agree with everything else Matt said about being a line item.
But there are certainly things you could do during law school. Don't walk away with the wrong impression. There are certainly lots of things you can and should do while you're in law school to prepare your resume to be more attractive as an in-house candidate, either right upon graduation or a couple of years afterwards, okay? Lots of outreach, lots of organizations. ACC, American Corporate Counsel Association,
yep,
recently changed its name to American Corporate Counsel
Association.
But it's still on ACCA.org, ACCA.org. Excellent, excellent place. WMACA, the Washington area chapter, is the most active in the nation. Excellent place to do outreach, do networking, to attend programs, etc. Let's motor through. Lobbying firms, legislative advocacy. Whew, okay. Certainly nowhere else than in Washington, D.C. are you going to have, although in certain state capitals you will have a legislative affairs practice area tucked into a law firm, in addition to just having lobby shops out there. And you don't have to be a lawyer to be a lobbyist, so you will have lobby shops out there that are independent, separate from law firms, but you'll have lots of law firms out there, Patton Boggs, for instance, that are really powerhouse lobbying shops in addition to full-service legal firms. These are positions, again, that are very attuned to hiring people who are focused in on the issue and not just someone who, hey, you know, I've always liked politics, I was a poli sci major, and I think lobbying would be really cool. It's like, no, I worked at FERC. I understand where the price of a barrel of Saudi sweet oil is. Where what's a barrel of Saudi sweet oil going for today? Right. Right. Good. I mean, you got to know this stuff. It was in a six-month slump. It just popped over $60 yesterday, $62 a barrel. Why is that important? I mean, you have to know what's going on in the economy. If you want to say you want to go in there being a an expert on energy law, you don't know the price of crude oil, your credibility goes. So do you know the issue? Do you know the market dynamics? Do you know what's driving their clients? And can you speak intelligently to that? Is going to be very, very important, as well as, hey, kid, do you have any contacts? I mean, that helps. Did you work for Senator so-and-so, Congresswoman so-and-so? Do you know these issues? Do you know her politics? Do you know his politics? And by the way, we service clients in that milieu, and you're trying to make that direct connection. That's very, very helpful.
Right.
Pick up on that at all?
I don't really know much about the lobbying stuff, so everything.
Roll, and there's a good section on our website. Roll call is a must read. The Zoo, the Hill Zoo, as well as the Washington Post, as well as whatever industry that you're absorbed in. You'd better be reading Computer World. You'd better be understanding what's going on if you're interested in IP, high-tech issues. You've got to know your industry. So if you're reading Popular Mechanics, Computer World, well, that's a Popular Mechanics, that's not illegal. Of course not. But if that's where our clients are, you better know what's driving their business.
And the most important aspect of that, just to reiterate, is being somebody that's out there networking. Most of these lobbying positions are through contacts, word of mouth. People know each other. That's why law firms don't even use headhunters for their government relations practices, because people in these practices are so good at networking with each other and connecting that that's what they're doing for a living. So you have to demonstrate a willingness to pick up the phone, call people, introduce yourself, and not live under a rock if that's an area that you want to get into.
And there, again, there are some resources out there in addition to the one I just mentioned. Opportunities in Public Affairs is one. The Roll Call, Washington Post.
Legal Times.
Yeah. Legal Times has a lobbying newspaper as well.
Lobbying supplement.
A lobbying supplement as well as its own
Influence.
Influence. A separate publication put out by the Legal Times. And then also looking, as you're looking in the Washington Post, for instance, you'd want to look at associations. Because I've read the word associations, they're going to say, legislative advocate needed for an association dealing with refrigerator magnets. It's like, you didn't look on associations for a lobbyist position. You're looking on the L for lobbyists or legislative affairs. So it's being broader in your search and sitting down with one of us to really engineer what the search is going to look like, so they're not just sort of slapping it together out there. Besides OCI, how else do folks hire? I think you sort of address that in a lot of different ways here. Do people address it in the context of the federal government, in the context of the small mid-sized firm, in the context of public interest organizations, in the context of judicial clerkships?
If there's one thing that I'd like you all to remember, just if you can envision a picture of a telephone, do not hesitate to pick up the phone and call people and create opportunities. Because the biggest mistake that people make is expecting opportunities to fall in their lap. And with the number of law students out there, you really have to be proactive in terms of seeking out opportunities, meeting people, and creating opportunities. And the best way to do that is to take advantage of the alumni network. And I know Matthew in the Career Services Office has a whole database of alumni mentors that are willing to speak with you and give you advice and help you. So really the best thing you can do, in addition to all of these things, to outreach and be proactive in terms of connecting with people.
All right. Let's,
for the good part,
rock it on through. Why you actually came here?
Everyone have this chart here.
You missing a few?
This is a four-page chart that goes through all the practice areas in D.C. and talks about, in my opinion, what I'm seeing from the lateral side. And one other good way to find out for an entry-level position what is an attractive or hot area is to look at the law firm's website for the lateral openings. And if the lateral openings have six positions for people in corporate securities, odds are they're going to be looking for entry-level people in that area as well. So you can use the lateral openings as a strong indication of what the hiring positions are in the entry level. So just to explain this,
Go for it. One quick thing. And on the other side, the public side of that, what Dan was saying, you know, what's the engine of growth? What is this firm producing? Therefore, what are the hot practice areas? On the public side of this, in terms of the public sector, federal government, you want to look at the budget. Where's the budget going? Where's the money going? And which agencies are getting it? Certain agencies will publish on their websites the breakdown of their budget, including how much money is allocated towards the hiring of new attorneys. This is about being, again, the captain of your own search. We'll help you. We'll talk to you about strategies, et cetera. But it's, you know, there's a lot of self-direction here, and there's a lot of entrepreneurial lawyering research skills that are required to really uncover these opportunities. Sorry.
Right. Oh, no, that's okay. Just to explain how this chart works, again, we've got the practice area on the left side. The second one is the market size. The larger the market, the more positions there are. Then the next column is the hiring demand, talking about how much of a need there seems to be right now. Pickiness, again, is the emphasis on credentials. Something like an appellate practice is ridiculously picky. Something like patent law, where if you already have a computer science or an electrical engineering degree, it doesn't matter if you have a 2.6 GPA. And then the last one, the sexiness factor, how many people are interested from law school in getting into these areas. So the less sexy a practice area is, the better your chances generally, because there are not as many other people clamoring for the positions. So does anyone have any, rather than just go through and read what you could quickly see. Oh, and the last one, there's a chart here. It's a survey of selected lateral law firm opportunities in Washington, D.C. This chart just shows how many positions we had in certain practice areas. Don't take this too literally. If you are gung-ho on an area that only had one position, don't worry about it, because this is, you know, from a headhunter's point of view. And a lot of other practice areas aren't listed here, such as family law, criminal defense. So these aren't listed here because headhunters like me usually don't place in those areas. So just keep that in mind. This is just kind of a snapshot of things, but it gives you an idea of where some of the hot areas are.
So and what are some practice areas that you, since we have a smaller group, maybe sort of throw them out? Yes?
Energy
law.
Mostly in the administrative side.
Okay, that's a big question. One, on the transactional side or the admin side, regulatory side?
Yeah, I got that lecture last week from Clinton and Justice.
Good.
But everybody that I've talked to said, FERC.
You want us to say anything different?
No, because I mean, Energy Law Society, I don't think we touched on that, but there's so many clubs here, and...
Well, let me tell you about my one interaction with someone from the Energy Law Society,
okay,
who happened to be a very good networker and who happened to get a unpaid internship at FERC because he was networking at a Habitat for Humanity program that he participated in on a Saturday to help build houses. What's that?
That's in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then what happened? Well, he was unpaid. Poor me. Oh, well, not for long, because he knew the president of the American Bar Association, the ABE, the American...
The
Energy Bar Association.
ABA's E-N-R, whatever.
Anyhow, I think it was the ABA's one, that decided this kid was worthy enough of funding, so they actually paid him for his summer work at FERC.
Yeah.
And by the way, now, it just came to me yesterday, that a big partner at a big 1,000-person law firm asked him to submit his resume to that firm. Okay? Was there a job posting? No. Was it through fall recruitment? No. This guy had the greatest grades in the world? No. What did he do? He put himself at the right place at the right time. He put his money where his mouth is vis-a-vis his interests, and he let people know what his interests are. Okay? That's sort of an aside to particularly energy law. In case you didn't know, energy law is hot.
And I think it's great that you all came to this today, everyone, because this is the type of thing, if you're proactive, you're going to find out a lot of information and be put at an advantage over other people that don't proactively go out and seek opportunities. So I think it's great that you all came here today, and this is, I think you all are probably the types of people that will be more proactive in terms of finding opportunities. So to an extent, we're probably preaching to the choir a little bit here,
right.
But it's great. I think all the time, people that are attending these things the most are the people that are usually the most successful in their strategies. Other questions, other practices?
Another question. Military lawyer, Jaguar experience transferred to private practice.
Have you had experience with
that? Yeah, I've gotten a number of JAG people contacting me. It's pretty rare because you're usually working on, like, misdemeanors and those types of... I mean, you've got great litigation skills. For trials, more transferable to a smaller practice where you're in court doing trial work. And this is one other quick distinction, thank you for that question because it draws something to me. The difference between litigating at a large firm, they call it litigation, but it's more case management. You're rarely ever going into court. You're rarely taking depositions. Generally, it's managing a huge case that's going to be several years long. You're managing discovery, brief writing, research. Trial work is much different. That's when you're going to court and you're representing defendants or plaintiffs. You know, it's much more in court. So those types of trial practices in court are going to be much more receptive to JAG experience because it's those types of skills are much more relevant to their practices as opposed to large law firm practices where it's case management and it's, they're very rarely going to be able to utilize your fantastic ability to think on your feet to provide hearsay objections.
That's what I've seen. Mostly they go into criminal practices, very volume-driven, smaller practices, hang their own shingles, hook up with a bunch of other JAG folks. It's very, because, you know, JAG, you get thrown right in. It's like, hey, you got court-martial tomorrow. Just go. So attorney general's offices are receptive to that kind of background and those sort of hit the ground running when you can, smaller boutique practices. Unless there's a real pedigree in terms of your academic experience that goes behind it, you know, I think the larger firms are not going to be as interested.
Yeah, but we have placed several people from JAG in large national law firms in general commercial litigation, but it's because they had really strong credentials, top 5% or things like that. Any other questions, practice?
I just had a question in terms of the trends on here. I was just wondering how applicable these are to the market as a whole across the country and also how applicable they would be outside of the large firm practice areas, like in terms of like a mid-sized firm or maybe a more regional firm.
That's a great question. I think I wouldn't apply this to other cities. Generally, and there may be some relevance, but I speak with my colleagues in New York, California, and hot areas here don't even exist out there, and vice versa. So I wouldn't apply this. If you're interested in sort of what the state of the market is in different cities, one thing you can do is if you go on our company's website, it's bcgsearch.com. We have a quarterly newsletter that you can sign up to for free, and it provides a state of the market report in all major legal markets across the country. And so that's something that you can sign up for and get, and it will show you what are hot practice areas by different cities. I think there are probably 25 markets.
And in terms of how these translate and spill down to the smaller firms, I would say probably very relevant, but as Dan said earlier, this is just a snapshot of practice areas that tend to be large firm driven. To the extent that there are parallel boutique firms that have these kinds of practices, well, they're going to be doing pretty well economically as well. However, this does not look at all at the family law practices, the general civil slip and fall practices, maybe the trust and estates, I don't know. So there are lots of practice areas that aren't on there that are doing very well, thank you very much, here in the region. And that's a conversation we could have. There's so much you can do.
There are a lot of smaller practice areas that are family law, immigration, that are a lot of opportunity, just not at the bigger firms.
Right.
Other questions?
Well, I would like to thank Dan Binstock for being here with us. Dean Jaffe, any words you'd like to add?
It's just a pleasure listening in and hearing from a graduate who's doing very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for attending.